Hello and welcome to Fine Print, the double scrutiny of the story and its coverage. I'm Amir Arfa, but first, as always, a quick check of the big print. The big print goes. The Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Paper and Israel lobby sparks heated debate. The swarm over the Israel lobby. Lifting the veil on lobby. And the lobby. To help us track the fine print, we're joined all the way live from London by Jeffrey Alderman, editor of Jewish Chronicle. From Washington by Jeff Steinberg, senior editor of Executive Intelligence Review magazine, the EIR. From New York by Dr. Herbert London, president of Hudson Institute, one of America's leading think tanks. By the phone, from San Jose, California, William Beeman, professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology, University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, right now currently in California. I'd like to start, go straight to the paper, but first, rules of engagement, please brief and state the point, and of course, a big welcome to all our panelists. Now, straight to the paper, the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy, John Mearsheimer, Department of Political Science, University of Chicago, and Stephen Walt, John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University, March 2006. The paper has gone through several versions from 2002 to 2007. The most recent version is the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy, a New York Times bestseller published in September 2007. The paper was originally commissioned in 2002 by the Atlantic Monthly, which then rejected it. It became available as a working paper at the Kennedy School's website in 2006. The paper was finally published in March 2006 by the London Review of Books. A third revised version was published in the fall 2006 issue of Middle East Policy in late August 2007, and a large version was published as a book. And now we start, and especially for our viewers, just please stick to the comments made here. Well, please reserve judgment and final conclusion until the end of the show. We have a lot to cover, but start with the introduction here. The Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. U.S. foreign policy shapes events in every corner of the globe. Nowhere is this truer than the Middle East, a region of recurring instability and enormous strategic importance. Most recently, the Bush administration's attempt to transform the region into a community of democracies has helped produce a resilient insurgency in Iraq, a sharp rise in world oil prices, and terrorist bombings in Madrid, London, and Oman. With so much at stake for so many, all countries need to understand the forces that drive U.S. Middle East policy. The U.S. national interest should be the primary object of American foreign policy for the past several decades, however, and especially since the Six-Day War in 1967, the centerpiece of U.S. Middle East policy has been its relationship with Israel. The combination of unwavering U.S. support for Israel and a related effort to spread democracy throughout the region has inflamed Arab and Islamic opinion and jeopardized U.S. security. This situation has no equal in American political history. And the article raises the question, why has the United States been willing to set aside its own security in order to advance the interests of another state? Let's go straight to Jeff Steinberg joining us from Washington. Jeff?
Well, I think that probably the most important thing to say is that because of the strategic role of the United States in world affairs affecting every region of the globe, there is scarcely a country in the world that does not have some kind of lobbying operation in Washington, D.C. I'm sitting here on M Street, and just one block away, K Street is just full up and down of lobbying firms that work for everything from industry to foreign governments representing their interests with the U.S. Congress and the executive branch. Countries as small as Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Bangladesh, all hire Washington, D.C. lobbyists to represent their interests. I think that what we're dealing here with is with, frankly, a situation where the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, and a number of other affiliated organizations happen to simply be more effective than most. They have a more mobilized constituency here in the United States, both among American Jews and also among a large and growing number of Christian evangelicals who've lined up in a political partnership with certain right-wing circles in Israel. And so, you know, to my mind, it's kind of a tempest in a teapot. The issue here is not, is there or is there not an Israeli lobby? Of course there is. It's a fact of life that everybody here in the United States recognizes. I think the issue is that they just happen to be disproportionately effective and therefore do a better job than most other lobbies in making their point of view felt in the corridors
All
of power
right.
here in town.
Now, let's move on with the paper. It says, it answers its own question by saying one might assume that the bond between the two countries, that is the United States and Israel, is based on shared strategic interests or compelling moral imperatives. As we show below, however, neither of those explanations can account for the remarkable level of material and diplomatic support that the United States provides to Israel. Dr. London in New York.
Well, I obviously disagree with that statement.
Let's
it seems
have your
to
comment.
Me that what you have is a nation that has democratic impulses along the lines of the United States in an area that does not know democracy at all. It's also true that if you're looking at Israel as an example, it does have 20% of its population that is Arab, and not only the 20% that's Arab, but those 20% that have all of the rights as other Israeli students. Where else in the Middle East do you find an example where Jews residing in an Arab nation are possess any of those rights? So I think that there is an obvious moral as well as strategic reason for the alliance with Israel. But there are three points that I want to make about the Mearsheim or Wall thesis that I think are important. I'd like to lower the rhetoric a little. Number one, as has already been suggested, there's lobbying of every kind in a democratic society. Israel should be, or I should say the Jewish lobby should be provided with the same rights as any other lobbying group. Second is that what's overlooked in the Wald-Mearsheimer thesis is the fact that the Arab groups in the United States play a very powerful role in lobbying our Congress and in lobbying across the entire cultural spectrum. It's not at all coincidental that if you look at Middle Eastern studies programs in the United States, Saudi money plays a very powerful role in influencing the character of those programs, from the Edward Said chair at Columbia to what is going on at the Rand Corporation in California. So to suggest that it is only the Israeli lobby or the Jewish lobby is absurd. And third, I think Walton Mearsheimer, who should be far more sophisticated about policy perspectives, do not understand how policy is actually created in Washington. The President of the United States and the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor are not affected by what is suggested by any of the lobbying groups. It is merely one of many considerations that go into the policy calculus. If you're trying to think through how policy is made, it is not simply because someone has lobbied and now the State Department or the Defense Department decide to adopt that policy perspective. So in a way, this notion that there is somehow a nexus between what is being done by AIPAC and what the policy emerges on in Washington, D.C., is in some sense greatly exaggerated.
Now, speaking of democracy, you just alluded to democracy and Israel being a democracy, but the paper also has something to say about that. It says aiding a fellow democracy is one of the reasons why one might assume that U.S. is supporting Israel categorically, and it says American backing is often justified by the claim that Israel is a fellow democracy surrounded by hostile dictatorships. That's pretty much the assumption you put forth. And it answers that and says, this rationale sounds convincing, but it cannot account for the current level of U.S. support. After all, there are many democracies around the world, but none receives the lavish support that Israel does. The United States has overthrown democratic governments in the past and supported dictators when this was thought to advance U.S. interests, and it has good relations with a number of dictatorships today. Thus, being democratic neither justifies nor explains America's support for Israel. The shared democracy rationale is also weakened by aspects of Israeli democracy that are at odds with core American values. Here it attacks the Israeli democracy, and it says it is basically at odds with the U.S. And you said 20% of minorities exist in there. The article refers to those people. It says Israel's 1.3 million Arabs are treated as second-class citizens. And it says, given this conception of citizenship, it is not surprising that Israel's 1.3 million Arabs are treated as second-class citizens, or that a recent Israeli government commission found that Israel behaves in a neglectful and discriminatory manner. And here is a quote, and the article brings this quote from an Israeli the government commission. And it says, similarly, Israel does not permit Palestinians who marry Israeli citizens to become citizens themselves and does not give these spouses the right to live in Israel. The article goes on and on mentioning why the mention of the word democracy would not fit Israel if we call what we have in America democracy, Dr. London.
May I respond?
That's what you've just
since you've
said.
Addressed the question to me, number one,
yes, Dr. London.
20% of the Arabs that live in Israel are provided with all of the rights of Israeli citizens. The idea that there are not is clearly misguided. The second point about the lavish contributions that are made by the United States to Israel, clearly they are lavish, but not as lavish as the contributions that are made to Egypt as well. Keep in mind that after the arrangement between Sadat and Rabin, that the United States provided, the United States provided very, very lavish and continues to provide very lavish foreign aid to Egypt. Hardly a democracy, but obviously a country that has been aligned with the United States to some degree. So I think that there is, again, a kind of overarching concern about Israel that lacks the kind of perspective that is needed in understanding America's role in the Middle East. It is not only Israel that receives our aid, and it is not only Israel that is, of course, the target for the kind of concerns that the United States has in the Middle East. And the kind of perspective that you have from Mearsheimer and Walt clearly raises a number of questions about why the obsession with Israel, when in fact you could make the claims about other Arab states as well.
Professor,
I'd like to take up that point. The quotations that you've just read from do, in my view, reflect the obsession of Mearsheimer and Walt about Israel to the negation of many other factors in American foreign policy. Incidentally, contrary to what they say about Palestinian Arabs being second-class citizens in Israel, earlier this year, I may remind you, the acting president of the State of Israel was, in fact, a non-Jew. But leaving that aside, I can think of many examples of American foreign policy initiatives which have nothing whatever to do with the so-called Israeli lobby. For example, the decision to bomb Serbia by NATO, led by the USA, in order to defend Muslims in Kosovo. This had nothing to do with Israel's strategic interests. It's difficult for me to see how it could have been in Israel's strategic interest for that bombing to take place. I don't think Israel had any say in that decision, and I don't think that the Israeli lobby or AIPAC had any influence on that decision. Surely, the truth about Mearsheimer and Walt is this. Here we have two academics who are disillusioned with the fact that Imperial America has suffered foreign policy reverses since 1967, and they're looking for a scapegoat. And they think they've found one in Israel. They've taken an interesting idea, the impact of the Israeli lobby, that's fine, but they've then ratcheted it up to the nth degree in order to blame Israel for America's foreign policy reverses. Isn't that the truth about the article and the book?
Now, one major gist
of... May I say something?
All right. I'd like to have Professor Beeman, too, and then we'll go back. We have Professor Beeman also standing by, joining us by the phone from California. But before that, I'd like to read another quote from the article. It says, other special interest groups have managed to skew U.S. foreign policy in directions they favored, but no lobby has managed to divert U.S. foreign policy as far from what the American national interest would otherwise suggest, while simultaneously convincing Americans that U.S. and Israeli interests are essentially identical. The gist of the article is that no other lobbying group has ever been able to move the United States away from serving its own national interest in favor of another country. Professor Beeman.
I think that what our other colleagues have said, Professor Alderman and Professor And Professor Hudson, Professor
London.
London, yes, of course, at the Hudson Institute. I'm very sorry. Is essentially correct, but there's one factor that I'd like to add, and that is that the various groups in the United States who've been lobbying on behalf of Israel, and there's no question that they exist, have been especially effective in a particular way that has to do with the American political system. That is, they are responsible for contributing enormous amounts of money to American elections. And in particular, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee has been responsible for vetting political candidates and throwing enormous amounts of money behind candidates whom they feel will be making decisions that are favorable to Israel. And in this way, they have been very effective, more effective than most other lobbies in the United States. What we find is in our assessment of lobbies is that except for the American Association of Retired Persons, AIPAC turns out to be the most influential public affairs committee in the United States today in terms of its effect on elections and on public policy. When AIPAC has its national convention, every politician in Washington shows up. They don't dare stay away. The endorsement of AIPAC is crucial for any politician who wants to win an election in the United States. And disapproval from AIPAC is almost a certain barrier to actually being elected. And so they work very carefully to establish themselves at the grassroots of American politics. And of course, the decisions that come out of Congress are going to be biased in their favor.
Now, the article goes on, the paper, if you will, goes on and says indisputable facts. And it says some readers will find this analysis disturbing, but the facts recounted here are not in serious dispute among scholars. Indeed, our account relies heavily on the work of Israeli scholars and journalists who deserve great credit for shedding light on these issues. We also rely on evidence provided by respected Israeli and international human rights organizations. Similarly, our claims about the lobby's impact rely on testimony from the lobby's own members, as well as testimony from politicians who have worked with them. Readers may reject our conclusions, of course, but the evidence on which they rest is not controversial. And here, further down, it uses the word great benefactor, and it starts enlisting some of the aides gone to Israel from the United States, the assistance, and it says total direct U.S. aid to Israel amounts to well over $140 billion in 2003 dollars. Israel receives about $3 billion in direct foreign assistance each year, and it goes on talking about the aid Israel receives, not only financially, but other aids. It says most recipients of American military assistance are required to spend all of it in the United States, but Israel can use roughly 25% of its aid allotment to subsidize its own defense industry. And it goes on and on and on talking about U.S. categorical support for Israel. And further down it says, since 1982, the United States has vetoed 32 United Nations Security Council resolutions that were critical of Israel, a number greater than the combined total vetoes cast by all the other Security Council members. It also blocks Arab states' efforts to put Israel's nuclear arsenal on the International Atomic Energy Agency's agenda, so on and so forth. But, Jeff, the driving point here is swerving the United States away from serving its own national interest by supporting Israel. Why?
Well, who are they to define what America's national interest is?
Let's have Jeff on this, and I'll go straight to you, Jeffrey. Mm-hmm. First, let's have Jeff Steinberg.
Let me give an example, which I think is probably one of the factors that motivated two fairly well-known, quote, realist scholars, Walt and Mearsheimer, to take on this political maelstrom. There is no situation I can think of that's comparable when it comes to leading policy influences in the United States being also leading policy influencers in Israel. We had the specific case in July of 1996 of a study that was prepared under the sponsorship of an Israeli think tank called IASPIS, which was written on behalf of the incoming Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The study was called A Clean Break. It was written by Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, David Wormser, Mayrav Wormser, and three or four other people who were all Americans and who were perfectly free to conduct a policy study and present it to the Israeli government. And it was, in fact, a policy that was not just adopted by Prime Minister Netanyahu, but he delivered almost verbatim the words of the policy paper addressing a joint session of the U.S. Congress, again in July of 1996. Now, when the Bush administration came into office, many of those people assumed senior positions within the U.S. government. Doug Feith became the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Policy. David Wormser was at the Pentagon and later became a top aide to Vice President Dick Cheney. He only left that post over the summer. Richard Perle headed the Defense Policy Board. These were all organizations that played a major role inside the U.S. government in, for example, shaping the decision to carry out what's now a disastrous invasion and occupation of Iraq. So there's, I think, legitimate and justifiable reason for concern when you have a gray area where you have individuals who are clearly part of the neoconservative political movement in the U.S., but who on other occasions have been involved very closely in shaping the policy of the Israeli government. That's one of the areas where I think flags get
Jeff, we'll have to take a break for now. Just a few moments, and we'll be back with this heated discussion on the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Don't go away. We're back with Fine Print, the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy. Joining us from London happened to be Jeffrey Alderman, editor of Jewish Chronicle. We're joined from Washington by Jeff Steinberg, senior editor of Executive Intelligence Review Magazine, the EIR. From New York, we're joined by Dr. Herbert London, president of Hudson Institute, one of America's leading think tanks. By the phone from San Jose, California, Professor William Beeman, professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology, University of Minnesota, Minneapolis. Now back to the paper. This extraordinary.
May I say something? Sure.
Definitely. Well, I'll let you have the first say, but let me start with this quote from the paper, and then the day in court is all yours. This extraordinary generosity might be understandable, the paper says, if Israel were a vital strategic asset or if there were a compelling moral case for sustained U.S. backing, but neither rationale is convincing. Dr. Alanda, the paper contends that Israel is now no longer a strategic partner, rather a strategic burden. Now, let's have your comments.
Well, first of all, I think that that's largely untrue. The presence of Israel as a democratic state in the Middle East has a profound effect and a cascading effect on other states in the area. But more important, let me address some of the issues that have been raised. One, I think it's undeniable that AIPAC is a very effective organization and that the lobbying has been effective. I don't know if there's anything wrong with that. Obviously, if there were other lobbying groups, that would be just as important as what AIPAC does. And there are other lobbying groups, a point that I want to come to in just a moment. The second part is that what's conspicuously absent from the Mearsheimer-Wall thesis is any discussion of the role that Arab states are playing in trying to influence American policy. When you talk about the lavish contributions to Israel, and indeed they have been lavish, they're equally lavish in Egypt, as I suggested before. No mention is made of Egyptian aid that has been given by the United States in the book. And so I think that that is an extraordinary absence, but perhaps the most significant absence is the role that Saudi money plays in the United States, not only in sovereign contributions, but in sovereign investments that play a profound role in not only shaping economic policy, but also shaping cultural and political policy in the United States. The Saudis are now playing a dramatic role in the United States. Sovereign investment by Dubai and Saudi Arabia are extraordinary. All you have to do is look at the money markets to get an understanding of that. And yet, that is not considered. So when you talk about the role that have been made, that's been made by AIPAC, I think that one, it's exaggerated, and two, does not take into account the role that is played by Arab money. And last, let me just make a point about the four people that I know very well, Pearl and Doug Feith and the Wormsers. Now, it's true that they had some relationship with Netanyahu, but what was not mentioned by the fellow who made a comment about this just a moment ago is that after Netanyahu, that is Barak, they had no influence in that government, nor do they have any influence today. So to suggest that because they happened to engage in a discussion with Netanyahu, and then three of them played a role in a future government, that there was necessarily a tie-in, is really a stretch of the imagination, having very little to do with any reality.
Now, Dr. London, the paper explicitly says it does corroborate exactly what you have to say. It says, well, Israeli lobby is just another lobby. It just does its job better, and it starts giving its strategies how it does its job, and we'll get to the details on that point. And the second point you just mentioned about the article that about the Egypt's aid and stuff, aid to going to Egypt, also the second largest recipient of U.S. aid in the region. The question would be, perhaps, this begs the question, well, do we have an Egyptian lobby in the U.S. veering U.S. policy toward Egypt, so like we have?
You have an Arab lobby in the United States.
All right, of course we do.
All right. Now, the question is, now let's go to Jeffrey Alderman joining us from London. Jeffrey, I'd like to have your take here as well, but I'd like to have your comment here also on whether or not Israel still happens to be a strategic liability or, as we have AIPAC trying to suggest, no, strategic partner. Now, I'd like to read this paragraph for you. According to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's website, the AIPAC's website, the United States and Israel have formed a unique partnership to meet the growing strategic threats in the Middle East. This cooperative effort provides significant benefits for both the United States and Israel. This claim is an article of faith among Israel supporters and is routinely invoked by Israeli politicians and pro-Israel Americans. And then the article goes on to debunk this, showing why the partnership between Israel and the U.S. is no longer a strategic one. It's gone away from the World War II status and post-World War II status to right now Israel being a strategic burden. Jeffrey Alderman, your comments.
Yes. Incidentally, I'm not the editor of the Jewish Chronicle. I'm just a columnist for it. Okay. Now let me answer
Thanks
your
for the
question.
Correction.
Thank you. You know, there are many other factors that have influenced America's friendship to Israel. For example, the Munich massacre of Israeli Olympic athletes by Palestinian terrorists, the Entebbe affair, for example. These have had an impact on American public opinion and on American foreign policy. To say that it may not be in America's interest to have a strategic alliance, if you can call it that, with Israel, is to ignore the many other factors that impinge on the making of American foreign policy. It's one thing to say that the Israel lobby in Washington has been very successful, and we can all agree that it probably has been. But it's another to say that it actually controls American foreign policy. This is surely a reworking, this is a modernization of the old conspiracy theory. I myself have acted as a consultant to foreign governments, and I've acted as a consultant to the British government. Are we therefore to say that there's a Jeffrey Alderman lobby in the United Kingdom that somehow is perversely influencing United Kingdom foreign policy? That would be absurd. Mere time would have taken what we call a reductio ad absurdam here. They've taken an interesting view and turned it into a conspiracy theory.
Professor Beeman, I'd like to have your comments on whether or not AIPAC is really as influential as this paper states, reciting polls done saying that, well, the U.S. Congress, a poll done at U.S. Congress says back in 1997, and it cites some other polls saying AIPAC is the second most important lobbying organization inside the U.S., second only after ARP, that the pensioners, 38 million U.S. pensioners. Like to have your take on that, and also whether or not Israel right now happens to be a strategic partner of the United States rather than a strategic burden.
Well, I think that it's certainly true that AIPAC is one lobby group among many. But it's enormous size, and the enormous financial influence it has on the American political process makes it very, very different. Professor Alderman might be a one-person lobby, but he wouldn't be very effective compared to the effectiveness of AIPAC. As I said earlier, every American politician is vetted by AIPAC. They are scrutinized. They are interviewed by AIPAC. And if they don't pass a kind of litmus test in terms of their attitudes toward Israel, then AIPAC will give money to their opponents to make sure they're not elected. And so, therefore,
but that
we
is
end
the
up
American
a,
political process.
Yeah, of
but
course, it is
American
the American
democracy.
Political process. Is that, well, that's correct, of course, but that there is it is part of the American political process, and I'm not denying that. But if you're but you aren't denying it either, and so the case is that that this pro-Israeli group, this explicitly pro-Israeli group, has enormous influence on the American political process. Now, there may be nothing wrong with that.
Now,
that other people should just get more money together or be more powerful.
You might say that the gun lobby, what about the gun lobby? That has an enormous influence on the American political process.
Well, definitely. Jeffrey Alderman, exactly. This article also refers to the gun lobby, and it says that surprisingly, AIPAC stands head and shoulders even above the gun lobby, the NRA, National Rifle Association of the U.S. But let's move on with this article. Let's move on to the point. It's a very interesting point raised in this article. It says, to begin with, it's talking about terrorism now. Terrorism is a tactic employed by a wide array of political groups. It is not a single unified adversary. The terrorist organizations that threaten Israel, because Dennis is talking about Israel playing the being surrounded by terrorist organizations, that's why it needs support from the U.S. And it starts example Hamas and Hezbollah do not threaten the United States except when it intervenes against them, as in Lebanon in 1982. Moreover, Palestinian terrorism is not random violence directed against Israel or the West. It is largely a response to Israel's prolonged campaign to colonize the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. More importantly, saying that Israel and the United States are united by shared terrorist threats has a causal relationship backwards. Rather, the United States has a terrorism problem in good part because it is so closely allied with Israel, not the other way around. Jeff Steinberg.
Well, we're coming up just a few days from now to a conference in Annapolis, Maryland, in which the Bush administration at least purports to intend to press ahead for a long, long, long overdue solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I dare say that if either coming out of that conference or through other efforts, there were to be a just and fair settlement to the Israel-Palestine conflict, that the threats of terrorism to both Israel and the United States and many other things, I think, would be greatly reduced. I want to make a point here because I think that one of the unspoken issues here when you talk about, quote, the Israeli lobby, is the assumption that somehow or other Israel is some homogeneous place where everybody has one notion of what Israel's interest is. I'm reminded that when Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin came to the United States in 1992, when he first came into office, he had a very hard and confrontational meeting with some top AIPAC leaders, and he said, Labor Party's in power now, and AIPAC had become a lobby for a right-wing viewpoint more reflective of Likud than of the general view of the Israeli society. So, you know, Israel is divided on every single one of these issues, whether it's peace with the Palestinians, whether it's opening up a diplomatic negotiation to reach a peace agreement with Syria, withdraw from the Golan Heights. Israel has had an on and off relationship with Iran that continued after the Shah, extended through the Khomeini Revolution, has gone back and forth. There were many secret diplomatic initiatives back and forth between the two countries. So, you know, I think that the situation itself in the Middle East, the relationship between Middle Eastern countries and the United States, and I agree with Dr. London that there's a very powerful Arab influence, largely financial, largely tied to the Saudis, that also impacts on U.S. foreign policy. So it's a pretty, you know, wide-ranging fisticuff called American democratic political activity. But the idea that somehow or other there's one viewpoint in Israel and that there is one viewpoint that the Israeli lobby represents in Washington is also a bit off the mark. I find it disturbing. And I've been to recent AIPAC meetings. And I think that AIPAC represents a certain right-wing viewpoint in Israel. The idea that somehow or other we're in need of some kind of military confrontation with Iran, for example. That's not the overwhelming prevailing view in Israel, not even in the Israeli government. But it was presented by AIPAC as if this is somehow a universal Israeli view. So I worry that the Israel lobby presents a caricature and an oversimplification in the United States of what the actual very intense, constant debate that goes on inside Israel with a wide-ranging number of political viewpoints and shifting minorities and majorities. I don't think that's Mearsheimer and Wolf.
Right, Dr. London,
I'd like to. That's inherent in the lobby.
Dr. London, does AIPAC, yes,
about that?
Sure. Well, does AIPAC represent the Jews and, for that matter, all the Israelis and also all the Jews inside the U.S.? That's the question.
Well, I think Mr. Steinberg made a very important point. I think it's a caricature to suggest that all Israeli opinion is homogeneous. It's a divided country. You have many different parties. And there's a representation of a variety of views. Similarly, you could say the same about Jews in the United States. They do not all accept the AIPAC position. And so you get a variety of viewpoints in America. But the point that you made before, that Walt and Mearsheimer made before, and that is that Hezbollah and Hamas do not represent any kind of potential attack on the United States, is to some degree rather naive. Hezbollah is a subsidiary of Iranian foreign policy. The Iranian imperial ambitions to create a Shia crescent throughout the Middle East is, of course, a challenge to American interests in that area. And it's also true that if you're looking at the role that Hezbollah plays, it's a pernicious role, not only against Israel, but against Lebanon and other states in that area as well. So I think that American interests are being challenged by Iran, and Hezbollah does represent a very real threat to our interests.
Let me ask you this, Dr. London. If you Google the word imperial Iranian ambitions and imperial U.S., how many links would you find on Iran and how many links would you find on the U.S.? That was one of the first times I'm hearing this, imperial Iranian ambitions. During the past 28 years, and this is not some apology for what Iran does or what U.S. does, but during the past 28 years of this Islamic establishment in Iran, let's have this comparison between the two countries, the United States coming not only halfway around the world, but all the way around the world to Iraq and the entire region from Central Asia to, let's say, Caucasus to Iraq right now to the Middle East and all the American flags aflutter in the region. And then we're talking imperial ambitions of Iran. Now, if you'd like to have a comment on that, I'd like to hear that and then straight to Professor Beeman and have his comments.
Well, first of all, if you're going to rely on bloggers or what you think are these citations, I really don't put much stock in that. America has interests across the globe. We're a great power.
Mainstream.
Iran is not a great power, but it has regional interests and regional desires.
All right.
And there's no doubt if you were going to rely on the UN as you did before, and as Mearsheimer and Walt do, it is rather absurd because Israel has become the target for the Muslim lobby within the UN. Almost every condemnation that has occurred through the Human Rights Council has been against Israel, not against Darfur, not against China, not against Saudi Arabia, countries that clearly violate human rights. But almost all of the attacks are against Israel. So one could clearly rely on citations across the globe to arrive at your conclusion, but it's a misguided conclusion.
All right. Citations in Google do not necessarily come from blogs only. Well, we'll have mainstream American media from New York Times to Washington Post and all of that, and those would be included actually in those citations. But let's go to Professor Beeman. Professor Beeman, you've been all around the world as an anthropologist, and I'd like to have your take here on whether or not these countries, according to Mearsheimer and Walt, these are direct threats to the U.S. interests in the region, or basically U.S. simply going out of its way and all the way away basically from its own national interest to support Israel?
Well, with all due respect to Dr. London, his view of the Iranian ideology is pretty much out of date. I think that at the very beginning of the Iranian Revolution in 1978, 1979, there certainly were people in Iran who talked about spreading the Iranian Revolution far and wide. But today, Iran's leaders are by and large pragmatists. I don't want to get into a long discussion about Iran's leaders.
You think Ahmadinejad is a pragmatist?
Yeah, Mr. Ahmadinejad is only the president of Iran, and you should know that he has no control over the military, he has no control over foreign affairs, and he has no control over the nuclear program. The Iranian presidency is an extraordinarily weak office. And the United States was quite clear about pointing that out when Mr. Khatami was president, and the Clinton administration wouldn't deal with him because he was so weak and had no power. So Mr. Ahmadinejad is a convenient scapegoat for people who want to talk about Iranian imperial power, but he has no power as president to really affect any of the things that he's saying. He's quite a loud talker, but not able to carry out much action. So you have to look beyond Mr. Ahmadinejad to the about 120 people who make up the real core of Iranian power, and there's a lot of controversy in Iran as well. It's not a monolith. It's no more a monolith than Israel or the United States is. There's a great deal of political discourse in Iran, and I'm afraid that the characterization by the extreme right wing in Israel of Iran as being a real threat to Israel is overblown. The phrase that's oftentimes used in Israel is that Iran is an existential threat, and what does that mean? It has no meaning at all, and in fact, Iran is not a threat to Israel.
Let's get away from
any,
the issue.
In any real material
right.
sense.
Let's get away from the issue of Iran and back to the article, the paper that directly has to do with U.S. foreign policy and the Israel lobby. And the paper is entirely about whether or not the U.S. Is veering away from serving its own national interest by serving those of Israel. Now, it says further down, backing the underdog as one of the other premises for backing Israel by the U.S. And it says Israel is often portrayed as weak and besieged, a Jewish David surrounded by a hostile Arab Goliath. This image has been carefully nurtured by Israeli leaders and sympathetic writers, but the opposite image is closer to the truth. Contrary to popular belief, the Zionists had larger, better equipped, and better led forces during the 47 to 49 War of Independence, and the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, won quick and easy victories against Egypt in 1956, against Egypt, Jordan, Syria in 67, before large-scale U.S. aid began flowing to Israel. Jeffrey Alderman.
Well, let's remember that in the War of Independence in 1948, the Israel Defense Forces, the Haganah, was actually defeated by the Arab Legion on what is now called the West Bank. So I'm afraid that blows something of a hole in that particular theory. We haven't heard anything in this program so far about the views of Mr. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And according to the Al-Qaeda view, it is the duty of the Muslim world to wage eternal jihad, and you mustn't actually, says Al-Qaeda, you mustn't actually be surprised at American reaction, because that's the reaction of the infidels to the jihad that we wage on them. So this I think is a factor that Mearsheimer and Walt, from my recollection, simply don't take into account at all in their rather skewed analysis of the origins of American foreign policy. You know, 9/11, the tragedy of 9/11, was not visited upon the USA because of Israeli policy. It was visited on the USA because of a particular Islamist view of the world and what the world must do.
It actually does.
May I intervene here?
Sure. But before you intervene, Professor Beeman, the article does mention Osama bin Laden. I'd just like to mention that. It says U.S. support for Israel is not the only source of anti-American terrorism, but it is an important one, and it makes winning the war on terror more difficult. And it says there is no question, for example, that many al-Qaeda leaders, including bin Laden, are motivated by Israel's presence in Jerusalem, the plight of the Palestinians. According to the U.S. 9/11 Commission, bin Laden explicitly sought to punish the United States for its policies in the Middle East, including its support for Israel, and he even tried to time the attacks to highlight this issue. So it also does include
Bin
Laden.
You see, Chairman, that is not the Al-Qaeda view.
All right, let's have Professor Beeman have his comments. Professor Beeman, go ahead.
The question of Osama bin Laden is a very interesting one because, in fact, Osama bin Laden's original complaint against the United States didn't have anything to do with Israel or the Palestinian question. Really had to do with the American military presence on Saudi Arabian soil. He was also active in the Chechnya rebellion against Russia and against the Soviet Union. It was only later, as the Al-Qaeda mission became more and more prominent, that he began to realize that there was some real percentage in furthering his cause by then embracing the Palestinian issue as well. But if it was not the case that Israel and the United States were so closely related in the eyes of the Arab world and then maybe in the rest of the world as well, this particular kind of attack against the United States on the basis of its relationship with Israel would have failed. So in some sense, the Israel lobby book in dealing with Osama bin Laden obscures the fact that Osama bin Laden's original attack against the United States had really nothing to do with Israel.
Well, unfortunately, we have to call it a day. That was all the time we had for this edition of The Fine Print. Our thanks to all our guests for their time and views. Our thanks to Jeffrey Alderman, columnist, if you will, for the Jewish Chronicle, joining us from London, from Washington. We're joined by Jeff Steinberg, senior editor of Executive Intelligence Review magazine, the EIR. We're joined from New York by Dr. Herbert London, president of the Hudson Institute, one of America's most influential think tanks. By the phone, we're joined from San Jose, California, by Professor William Beeman, professor and chair at the Department of Anthropology at University of Minnesota, Minneapolis. Our thanks to all of you gentlemen, and our thanks, of course, to our viewers for staying with us. Always watch out for the fine print.